Thank you for listening to the Resources for Integrated Care podcast series, Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities and Behavioral Health, Leveraging Person-Centered Approaches. This podcast is excerpted from a webinar presented live on September 27th, 2023. In this podcast, Olivia Ayers, Clinical Director at Elevate, a certified community behavioral health clinic, shares information about systems of care for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and behavioral health conditions.
I am going to be spending some time with you all talking about how we support the systems that we are working with. So I work for the START Network. I work out of Iowa, and the START model is an evidence-based model that is based around supporting the system and individuals with an intellectual and developmental disability. So I'm going to spend some time with you all today talking about the START model and specific aspects of the model that can be integrated for a positive and effective systemic support. We can see here that the START's guiding principles include things like a strength-based approach. So this really pulls from positive psychology. Wellness-based also pulls from positive psychology, but this is really about the thought that the absence of a crisis does not mean that there is wellness there. We use the biopsychosocial model, trauma-informed care, cultural competency, and a person and family-centered approach. In the public health model, this is a piece of what is used in the START model that I just want to touch on some of these levels because we'll be referring to these throughout the presentation today. So we have a primary level. These are when services are provided to the community to build their capacity. So it's building your capacity to serve individuals today, but also it's building that knowledge base so that you can serve individuals in the future that you may not have even met yet. Secondary services, this is an area where service providers tend to spend most of their time. This includes direct services. So when we're providing a direct service to the system or to the individual that we're supporting, those would be considered a secondary service. And the last one is tertiary. So these are emergency services. They are typically very costly, and those include things like using the emergency department, being hospitalized, ambulance, things like that. This is an image of the public health model. So when we are in primary services, we are proactively supporting the system members to support individuals they are currently serving and will serve in the future. And we have the potential to defuse crisis before we even meet the individual. So we can learn things that defuse crisis. So when we meet new people or the people that we're serving right now, we can actually start to defuse those crises very proactively. And then you can see how the services funnel all the way down to tertiary services, and this is where the resources are very limited. We are reacting to crisis events that have already occurred, and the options for successful intervention are narrowing. So that's why we see our inverted pyramid where we start to get really small there in the tertiary services. Our goal is to get out of the tertiary level and to stay in that primary and secondary interventions. So when you support an individual or a system, the system can also be the ones that are in a crisis. When we're supporting a system in crisis, we have to respond to the tertiary need. There's a lot of safety factors that go into tertiary services, so we want to respond to those. And as we're doing that, we need to be learning from the crisis and planning for what we're going to do the next time. So following that crisis event, have a team meeting and talk about what happened, how did the system react, and what are we going to try next time when we move forward? What did we learn works? What did we learn did not work? So that we can continue to adjust that and get ourselves out of the tertiary services. And this takes us to another important aspect of the START model, the biopsychosocial model. The biopsychosocial model considers biological, psychological, and social factors, so it's really a holistic model of support. We want to learn and assess the individual's biopsychosocial baseline so that we can identify potential crisis early on and keep ourselves and those individuals out of that tertiary service usage. So, for example, I served an individual that appeared to be very depressed. And as a result, she was put on many antidepressant medications. She had been psychiatrically hospitalized on multiple occasions. And when we really used this model and considered the biopsychosocial reasons for a change in her baseline, through lots of services, we were able to identify she actually had extremely low vitamin D levels. And once we were able to get the vitamin D levels back on track and in that normal range, the depressive symptoms started to go away. And so then we were able to work with the physician prescribing medications to start slowly decreasing those, because now we know more and we know that she doesn't need all of those. So assessing biopsychosocial factors ensures that we catch what we might have otherwise missed. If I come about services only through my therapist's perspective and I miss that there's low vitamin D levels, I'm not going to see the progress that I'm hoping to see for that individual. A biopsychosocial lens helps us to prevent unnecessary interventions and guides us to the best possible interventions. So when we unnecessarily provide antidepressant medications, because that's what we thought we needed to do, if we use this model, we can identify when we don't need that and reduce some of those interventions. So another example, we served an individual that began hitting his head on walls. He started hitting staff and yelling, declining to engage in activities, and he was completely nonverbal. So this individual was taken to the emergency department many times. He was psychiatrically hospitalized many times. He was given antipsychotic medications after many, many months of this behavior going on. And we later found that he was having severe migraines and that he really just needed support for those migraines. We also identified, how can we identify a migraine is coming? So when he started to pace and tap his head with his hand, that was how we knew a migraine was coming and we can administer a PRN medication. So we had this crisis that was happening over and over and we kept trying to figure it out. We had consultations, we did observations, we had team meetings. And after trying many, many things, we identified migraines. And then we were able to really proactively plan with the primary care provider to keep that individual out of those tertiary services. So we had this backup plan in place. His primary care was willing to put in a standing order for migraine shot that he could get at the emergency department without an admittance to the emergency department, or going to his office if the office was open. And that was able to avoid tertiary services and also provide a lot of healing to the individual experiencing those migraines. This is going to take us to the three A's, as we call it in the START model: access, appropriateness, and accountability. Access is really assuring that all the services are inclusive and that they're community-based, they're offered in a timely manner so when that person needs them. Appropriateness is ensuring that we have the right system members. So if somebody has a seizure disorder but we recognize they don't have a neurologist on their team, we're missing an important system member and we want to bring that member into the team. Appropriateness is also ensuring there is linkage between providers to ensure that everybody is aware of the treatment plan. There's accountability to ensuring everybody knows the roles of each person within the system. Outcomes should be clear and data informed to provide quality and cost-effective services. So something that we can do is really supporting a system in utilizing these three A's. So positive psychology is a wellness and strength-based approach to services. This means the absence of crisis is not wellness. Positive psychology pushes us to supporting individuals not just in decreasing their crisis, but also increasing their quality of life and their overall wellness. Positive psychology gives us a strength-based foundation. So this means we know and incorporate the person's strengths, skills, and interests in helping us to defuse a crisis, but also incorporating those into their day-to-day life to ensure that they have a quality of life. Using person, family, system-centered language is really crucial for creating an environment that is solution-focused and uses a positive outlook. So you can see on the slide, there's a few examples here. So we might say a person is complaining of a headache versus they're reporting that their head hurts. This is a more workable problem. We can offer a PRN or we can reach out to a primary care provider if we need to. Attention seeking versus they're seeking connections. It's not as simple as they're just attention seeking, but they are seeking relationship and connection with people. How can we proactively ensure that they have that time for connecting with people to make sure that those needs are met? saying somebody's non-compliant versus their choices. So instead of saying they won't take their medication, saying their choices to not take their 4 p.m. medications, and the system can explore options and reasons as to why that might be. A difficult family member versus this individual's mother is the strongest advocate I have ever met, or this family member, this friend is invested in the individual's well-being. That makes that individual part, an important part of our system, and it makes any problems that we're having much more workable so that we can support those. So Seligman and colleagues like Dr. Dan Tomasulo reviewed research on other individuals that were studying happiness. And this is where the PERMA Plus model came into play. What they found was that individuals reporting high levels of happiness had a few things in their life. They all shared PERMA Plus in that research. So they focused on having positive emotions daily. They were engaged in something daily. They really tried to experience the world around them through that engagement. They had strong relationships and connections. They felt meaning. So meaning is being a part of something that feels bigger than yourself. They also experienced accomplishment, and then the plus was added later for overall health. So things like exercise, eating healthy, those types of things. So this is, of course, important that the individuals we're serving have access to PERMA Plus on a daily basis. But when we're supporting a system, our system also needs PERMA in their life. They need an opportunity to experience a positive emotion. They need to feel that meaning, like they are a part of something bigger. We need to have relationships and connections, accomplishment. They may complete a task that leads to some accomplishment. So that's another thing we can do to support our systems is we can mindfully choose to incorporate aspects of PERMA into our team meetings or into our, even our emails to give that little boost of happiness and support to our system members. Character strengths are also a large part of the positive psychology model. All people have character strengths that can be observed, celebrated, and built on to use a strength-based approach to our care. We can use character strengths to strength spot, is what we call it in START, other persons on the system. So you might notice that somebody within your system of care has a strength of humor, and how they use humor to defuse crisis and to bring joy and happiness to others, you might note that to them. For example, my top character strength is hope. This is hope for the future, and it's the belief that I have some control over my future and getting to the end goal. So when somebody on my team needs hope and encouragement, they need time to focus on what they can control versus what they cannot control, and what can be done to work towards a better future for them, their system, the individual. I'm their person. So knowing your system's strengths, their strength of character, can be really helpful in identifying which system members will be the most successful at completing a certain action step and how to build each other up through using each other's strengths of character. Systems functioning. Every system is looking for homeostasis. This is achieved through the system's unspoken rules, group norms. Each system you support will have its own set of unspoken rules. Part of what you are doing in care coordination is learning those rules so that you can join with them and we can start to shift small things that will really help pull us out of that tertiary services and build up quality of life for the system and for the individual that's being served. Resistance is a common reported concern for individuals within a system. So changes, whether the change is good or bad, it shakes up the homeostasis. Resistance doesn't come from a place of wanting to be difficult. It comes from a place of stress and anxiety. So we need to understand why there's some resistance, validate that it can be stressful, it can be scary to change things up, and that's what's going to help the system have the support that they need to be able to make the changes that need to be made. Another thing that we want to do is develop a common goal with the system. So this can be very general. Typically, when you're first entering a system, the common goal is very general. So an example of that could be, we all want Susie to be healthy and happy. Everybody can agree to that goal that our system has for the individual we're serving. The reason a common goal can be so, so vital for a system, even though we have such a simple goal here, is, especially when we start to see that homeostasis getting shaken up a little bit, we might see conflict where we have individuals within our system that are really on an opposite end of the spectrum, and we're having a hard time agreeing on what to do to move forward. Something that can make us not feel like it's us against them, but that it is a group effort, we are a team, and we are all here for the same reason, is a common goal. So when you have those two different, strong different opinions, you can remind the group of their common goal. We all want Susan to be healthy and happy. We all have the same end goal. We're just talking about getting there in a different way. And that can help bring back some more cohesion to the group to be able to make decisions together. We want to join with the system. So understanding those unspoken rules and joining with the system's common goal. Once you have joined with the system, this is where you can really find the opportunities to bring in some new ideas to the team, to start shifting some thinking and perspective on the services that we're providing. Active listening is vital for ensuring a system feels heard. Our nonverbals are really important, so be mindful of things like your facial expression, those minimal encouragers like head nods and those mm-hmms, your language, tone of voice, things like that. But there are four big aspects to active listening that I want to cover with you today. The first one is paraphrasing. Paraphrasing is saying the same thing back with slightly different words. And we use this intervention to allow the person to really hear what they're saying and process how other people are hearing that information so that we can make adjustments from there if we need to. Summarizing is another skill of active listening. This is reiterating the highlights. We've probably all been in meetings or situations where we are either the person or somebody in the meeting is sharing a lot of information, and we may be going down 10 different roads. But today's meeting was to do crisis follow-up, and so you can do a summary of the highlights of that information, and that helps us to keep the focus. What we're doing here today is this. If we go down 10 different roads at the same time, we won't be able to provide the same quality care and intense amount of care that the individual needs. So you want to focus on that one direction. Clarification is additional explanation. You're just asking for more information. And this is really helpful for your group cohesion. So things like developing a common goal, crisis planning, future interventions, those are all really helpful with clarification. And then reflection. This is rephrasing information. And this allows the person to hear their thoughts in a slightly new light. This really connects well to my previous slide where we talked about things like the differences between saying the person's complaining or saying the person is reporting something. Even just rephrasing it slightly can really change the light and the feel of the sentence. Interdisciplinary consultation. So using a biopsychosocial approach is very important because we know biopsychosocial factors really intertwine with each other. We can become focused on our own area of expertise, and then we can start to miss important information. An interdisciplinary team can really help to ensure that biopsychosocial is considered and supported. Now, some individuals have access to an interdisciplinary team. With my team, we actually have an interdisciplinary team within our group of people, and so we provide every single individual we serve with interdisciplinary consultation, typically multiple times, because we find so much value in it that we employ people that can do this. But even if you don't have access to something like that, where it's very easy to get at, you can still ask for consultation from medical professionals, from psychological professionals, and from somebody that really knows the individual's social life. There's some examples in this slide of who those different people may be, but getting together and being able to talk through what's going on is really your best practice for using the biopsychosocial model and identifying vulnerabilities. So at this point, I am transitioning a little bit more slightly off the START model, although this does relate to it, and we're going to talk a little bit more about polypharmacy. So polypharmacy, just to make sure we're all on the same page with what that is, it's the simultaneous use of multiple drugs that treat a single ailment or condition. So When we're missing biopsychosocial factors, this is a big contributing factor to polypharmacy. High levels of physical aggression, property destruction, suicidal ideations, and/or attempts, all of these things can result in polypharmacy in hopes of decreasing this unsafe behavior and hopefully decreasing the need for tertiary services. Polypharmacy does not treat the root cause, though. So if we are treating depression with multiple antidepressant medications, but we're missing that the root cause is that there is extreme low vitamin D, we're not going to see the improvements that we're hoping to see in that individual with the treatment model that we're using. So there's lots of literature out there on polypharmacy. And O'Dwyer found, he completed a study, and he found that most adults with intellectual disability that were over the age of 40 were experiencing what he labeled as excessive, and he defined excessive as 10 or more medications related to polypharmacy. What that means is that this population that was studied, these people were on 10 or more medications all to treat the exact same thing. That's a lot of medication to treat the same ailment or condition. Individuals with intellectual disability are 3 times more likely to experience polypharmacy than the neurotypical population is. Medications are often being used off-label. So off-label means that the medication is being used for something other than its intended purpose that's written on the bottle and what people would typically prescribe the medication for. So for example, a person with intellectual disability may be on multiple antipsychotic medications without any diagnosis or any symptoms of psychosis. And that medication that's being prescribed off-label typically is used to decrease an unwanted challenge like physical aggression. But prescribing off-label medications is not FDA approved because we don't know what the effects of using a medication without its intended purpose will be. Polypharmacy is correlated with things like falling, adverse drug interactions, mortality. The use of hospitalization actually increases. So even though the intent of polypharmacy is to decrease the tertiary service usage and unsafe behaviors, it's actually increasing hospitalizations. It's also increasing the length of stay that somebody is in the hospital, and the readmission for hospitalizations occurs sooner after their original discharge. So we're actually seeing a pretty big increase in the need for tertiary service usage. Polypharmacy is associated with increased health care costs and impairing the individual's overall functioning. Polypharmacy can lead to very complex drug interactions that can be fatal in nature. Just in our program, we have consulted with pharmacists, which is a wonderful resource that we love to consult with them. And they have called us in, 10 or 15 minutes later and said, we got to get these two medications stopped because these could actually be fatal for this individual. And then we can address that with the prescribing providers. But if there's no communication between them, things like that can accidentally occur. Polypharmacy is not only decreasing life expectancy, but it is also decreasing the quality of life. And sedation. Many medications that cause sedation are used in the ID population. Sedation is effective in decreasing crisis most of the time, although the absence of crisis is not wellness. And sedation through medication often leads to other costs, such as a decline in their quality of life and increased hospitalizations with longer hospital stays. So knowledge really is power. Encourage the system to know why medications are being prescribed. We can watch for common side effects that relate to those medications. So if the individual didn't have constipation concerns prior to new medications being started and now they do, that could be a side effect of a medication. And we want to report that to the physician that's prescribing this medication so they can assess whether this is something that they want to continue on or not. We also want to assess if the medication is working. If we're supporting an individual that is prescribed medication for the purpose of decreasing physical aggression, and we see no progress in that area, we want to make sure we're reporting that so that, again, the prescriber can reassess and decide if they want to remove that medication, if they want to try something else, if they want to increase the dosage. There's lots of different things that the prescriber may try to support the individual. And taking this kind of information, the side effects you're noticing, if there's any changes in the behavior, is a really great way of supporting an interdisciplinary team. So taking that to different parts of your system to get their thought process on why this might be happening can be very helpful in figuring out those things like, oh, this individual has a migraine, but they're nonverbal and weren't able to tell us that. We can find that faster and support that vulnerability faster. So this last slide is really more of a resource for you all. If you are not looking at the medications that individuals you're serving are on, I encourage you to take a look at those, learning a little bit more about what medications they're on and side effects and things like that can be really helpful for you when you're trying to do what we just talked about in our last slide, when you're trying to assess for changes and potential side effects. And if you look through this list, these are all medications that cause sedation. If you look through this list and you are familiar with some of the medications the individuals you're serving are on, it's very, very likely these look very familiar to you. Many of these medications are commonly used in individuals that have an intellectual disability for sedation purposes. That is all I have for today.
Great. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and so many valuable resources, Olivia. We will now move into our panel discussion and will welcome Dr. Pat Nobe, in addition to our esteemed speakers. My colleague John Janta is joining to facilitate the panel discussion and audience Q&A. John, I will turn things over to you.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Perfect. The first question for you, Dr. Nobe, what kind of support do family members or caregivers who support an individual with IDD and a behavioral health condition need?
Thank you, John. So families need consistency, and individuals with IDD and a behavioral health condition need a predictable routine. When that routine fails, the care and support falls on the family. Consistency means knowing who is supporting them outside of the family and that those support people really know the individual. The other thing I think caregivers need is crisis prevention strategies and training so they can avoid escalation of the incident, which could result in an inpatient or ED transfer, or worse, having to call the police. Effective communication is part of all of this.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Nobe. And again, this question is for you, Dr. Nobe. How can a plan or a health plan integrate family and caregivers into an individual's care team? And also, how can that plan support the entire care team?
Great. So family members or the primary unpaid caregiver are part of the care team. Planning cannot proceed without them. Particularly for individuals with a communication challenge, the family caregiver is the proxy for information. For example, when my daughter Mia was hospitalized this winter, she got asked with every clinical contact, what is your pain level on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being no pain? And she would always say 10, because in her understanding, there was either pain or no pain. But I knew she wasn't on level 10 pain, which would have required a heavy painkiller prescription, which she did not need. I had to educate the clinicians on how to ask that question or interpret it differently. That's not to say that people with IDD and a behavioral health condition have no agency. They do, and the task for the care team is to support that agency in decision-making as much as possible, drawing on the knowledge that the family caregiver has about the individual's situation. Technically speaking, if a person has a Medicaid home and community-based setting service or support, they are able to invite whoever they want to a care plan meeting. This may provide another perspective because families can sometimes limit a person's opportunities out of concern for their health or safety.
Thank you, Dr. Nobe. Thank you so much for sharing those insights. So this question is for all three of the panelists. In your experience, what is the most helpful action a health plan can take to support individuals with IDD and a behavioral health condition and their support network? And again, Dr. Nobe, we'll begin with you.
So I think the most important thing is to listen. The individual and their family and or their care partners have a history and an experience that preceded health plan involvement. Either they have learned to adapt or they will need support to learn ways to accommodate the needs of the individual differently but what they have lived is helpful to the care coordinators to build on, and also use modes of communication that work for the individual.
Thank you, Dr. Nobe. Dr. Whitwer, do you mind offering your perspective on this?
Yeah, sure. I think it's helpful for care plans to provide time for the team of care providers to meet. Also, we know that things like patient navigators can be incredibly helpful in these instances.
Now, thank you, Dr. Whitwer. And Olivia, how would you like to add to the response for this question?
Yeah, I think a biopsychosocial approach is really crucial. So explore biopsychosocial vulnerabilities and potential reasoning for changes in functioning or the behavior. Consider the individual's abilities and their vulnerabilities. So the individual's cognitive and adaptive functioning, their communication abilities, mental health functioning are all important aspects of the person to ensure that we are incorporating those. And goals should be truly person-centered and achievable based on their current functioning. In conjunction, health plans should consider the current system members and especially the primary caregivers to ensure what is being asked is doable for the current system's functioning and that the system feels supported through those recommendations and changes.
Great. Thank you all. So the fourth panel question is for all three of you again. What are the key indicators, such as environmental, physical, or behavioral, that could prompt action to prevent adverse outcomes, or prevent ER utilization or inpatient hospitalization, and address social determinants of health? And Dr. Nobe, you're free to go ahead first.
Thanks, John. So if an individual has a behavior support plan, then indicators can be set for elements of that plan. And if an incident, a behavioral incident, exceeds that indicator or gets close, then other interventions or actions need to take place. For example, you know, learning what environmental incidents trigger a behavioral crisis and learning how to de-escalate that incident or experience might prevent any de-utilization or an inpatient stay. The Council on Quality and Leadership did a study on the relationship between ongoing staff development and the incidence of the things mentioned here, adverse outcomes, ED utilization, et cetera. More staff development, the lower the incidence of adverse events, such as accidents, falls, abuse and neglect, ED utilization, and medication errors. They've also found a positive relationship between individuals being able to choose where to live and having robust community supports to less adverse incidents and where social determinants of health have an impact on their quality of life. These studies are more about the relationships of paid staff to the individual that they support, but the experiences that were studied also encompass what family caregivers do, and these are indicators that should be considered.
Thank you, Dr. Nobe. Dr. Whitwer, do you mind sharing your thoughts on these strategies?
Yeah, in order to identify those key indicators, it's important to ensure that the team identify early any changes in behavior. We want to also look for changes in engagement and activities of living or mood, and we want the team to be sure to communicate changes to the treatment planning team. It's also key to have a way to track behavior and other side effects to minimize adverse medication outcomes of side effects of those medications. We also want the team to take into account the individual's environment, their access to social engagement, and other activities that promote healthy living. Be sure to take into account any adverse experiences in the person's life and realize that many of the things that we don't think of as traumatic may be experienced as such by individuals with IDD.
Thank you so much, Dr. Whitwer. Olivia, I'll turn it over to you for your response.
Yeah, I think just to add what's been shared already, knowing that individual's baseline through that biopsychosocial lens is really helpful. Data tracking is so important. So looking, we call it ABC tracking, so looking at that antecedent, the behavior and the consequence, so what happened before, during, and after an incident can really help us to assess the changes and contribute to, that are contributing to those behaviors. And that's what's going to help us to plan in the future for what we're going to do next time. Tracking things that could impact them biopsychosocially, like if we're serving an individual that has had constipation concerns in the past and that's led to tertiary services, we might need to do some bowel movement tracking. And then the other thing I'll say about tracking is as much detail as possible is best for all data gathered. And it's really important that if you have a lot of different staff, that they're all tracking that data in the same manner. So set a very detailed and clear explanation of what's being tracked. Make the data tracker as easy to use as possible so that staff are able to use that. There's a lot of work that can be done during the development of the tracker that really saves the staff a lot of time. And this is so helpful for physicians and prescribers of medication to assess what the next best steps are.
Thank you so much. Again, directed to all three of our panelists, can you talk about how community-based organizations support meeting the needs of individuals with IDD and a behavioral health diagnosis? Again, Dr. Nobi, we'll start with your response.
Yes, thanks. So social isolation has been talked about as equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes every day. It's considered a significant health risk. It's also a safety risk. All people need connections, and community-based organizations, including faith communities, can support the individual and their families and caregivers to develop connections outside the home. My daughter works, she goes to swimming, she bowls, she attends church and helps with a Sunday school class, and she has a social life with a group of adults that does various activities once a month. And she does all of this without me. If Mia doesn't show up in any of these places where she is expected, someone is calling or texting me to ask where she is and is she okay. Her being out and about in the community is an important part of her health and safety.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nobi, for sharing that. Dr. Whitwer, do you mind sharing your thoughts?
Sure. And just really building on what Dr. Nobi has said, there are a number of community-based supports that adults with IDD can use. These can help to promote positive mental health, as she illustrated, looking at things like meaningful employment, community engagement, and social connectedness.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Whitwer. And Olivia, I'll turn it to you for your response to this question.
Yes, thank you. The system coming together to offer support, brainstorm, and make decisions together is a really important way to support the individual that's being served. Being attuned is also a key way that the community organizations are supporting. So being attuned to changes in baseline helps the team identify those early warning signs that something's not quite right and action can be taken proactively. Being open and curious, so think through a biopsychosocial lens to mitigate the overshadowing of vulnerabilities. And finally, creativity is crucial for community organizations supporting this population. Creativity is important for meeting everyone's needs with the resources that they have available to them. So creativity is also important for incorporating things like that PERMA Plus model that we talked about and ensuring that PERMA for each individual being served is incorporated to their daily life.
Thank you for listening. This podcast is presented by the Lewin Group and is supported through the Medicare-Medicaid Coordination Office at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. MMCO is dedicated to helping beneficiaries enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid have access to seamless, high-quality healthcare that includes the full range of covered services in both programs. To support providers in their efforts to deliver more integrated, coordinated care, MMCO is developing technical assistance and actionable tools based on successful innovations and care models. To learn more about current efforts and resources, please visit our website, www.resourcesforintegratedcare.com. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is @integrate_care, or follow Resources for Integrated Care on LinkedIn to stay up to date with our recent products and technical assistance.